Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to season 4, episode number 18 of Cinematica, and we've got the whole gang back together finally after what seems like, well, it is weeks and weeks and weeks. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio are...
Hello everybody, it's me.
And it's me, well, most of me.
Yeah.
I'm mostly here.
Thanks for getting up out of your sick bed to do the show.
That's it. You've been so sick.
Yeah.
Crazy sick.
You were even in hospital. I haven't been in hospital since, you know, I broke my arm as a kid. And, you know, I've never been in hospital because of, like, being ill.
Mm.
Only because of accident.
Mm.
And I went to see you in hospital last week, and you were very poorly indeed.
Mm.
And it took you a while to work out what food you should be, what the best options were on the Wellington Hospital. What did you learn? How do you cope?
Yeah. Can you get a trim latte?
Actually, thanks to Foursquare, when I checked in to tell people I was at the hospital, I wasn't going to, but I was like, I don't care. I want people to come visit me because I'm sad and lonely because my boyfriend has to work. Someone left a tip on Foursquare to choose the vegetarian option for hospital food at Wellington Hospital, and they are right. The food's good. It's good.
Okay.
I mean, because of having diabetes, I have to have a totally separate diet as well. So it's like vegetarian and low fat, low sugar. So it's very bland, but whoa.
What was that?
Welcome.
That was some bass.
Yeah.
So because you've got the DCP cinema next door now. What are we talking about?
We're talking about Kaylee and her illness.
Oh.
Yeah, not bass next door. Come on.
Well, I just thought that was an earthquake.
No.
Or a real big fart.
All right, Kaylee's illness, sorry.
So if you ever end up at the Wellington Hospital, definitely choose the vegetarian option. It's pretty good.
Okay.
So that's all I can say about that. I had a very nice... I was in this little pod. There's only like 4 beds. I was in this new sort of wing of the hospital. It was a very interesting mix of people. But one guy was really, really nice, and like he had some sort of like outpatient surgery or something. But
did you get lucky? Oh, I got lucky once. Have I ever told you this story?
At a hospital.
At the hospital? Not, well, I didn't get lucky. but I was...
You bought a lotto ticket, what?
Well, no, but I was quite unwell, and I was in hospital, right, and it was at night. And you know how I had these people next to me who are on these big breathing things, and they kind of made a lot of noise. It was really hard to sleep. I had like a pillow over my head, I had my headphones in, and I was just like, I couldn't take it. You know, it was a bit sad, but, you know, not just for me. And, And anyway, you know, hey, like I was hiding under this pillow at about 3 in the morning, and I could just feel a presence. I know. And I looked around. I lifted my pillow up, had a look, and there was this little old lady standing there. And she went, "Well, move over then." And I went, "What?" And she goes, "Well, come on, so-and-so." Like, and she went, "Move over." And I thought, well, okay, because I was always being brought up to be polite to your elderly people. Yeah, and you do. You do what's right. So I moved over and she hopped into my bed and I hopped out. I must say, I hopped out and I thought. And she goes, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I think I might go and find a nurse." And anyway, yeah, she was a bit lost, and it was a rather entertaining moment.
Oh.
A highlight of my 3 days.
Thankfully,
nothing like that.
No, there was a pretty crazy Scotsman at the end of the 4 beds. But there's a, across the little hallway, there's this very nice burly rugby player who overheard that I had been having trouble eating. So he gave me his like grapes and bananas, and his wife brought in some cookies and he gave me some cookies.
Good. Nice.
Those were nice.
Cool. Well, people are good.
Yeah. And then I was scared of the girl on the other side of me.
Take my stuff, I'll kill you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Animal Kingdom family going on.
Ooh, okay.
Mm.
But you're feeling what on a scale of 1 to 10? How would you? How, you're going to be able to? Do we need to prop you up to get through the show?
No, I did lay down on my desk and have a little like nap today at my desk. I think I'll be okay. I just had an orange.
All right. Well, hopefully this won't be too strenuous. But I am going to ask you to see whether you've been monitoring our mail.
Mm.
I was today. I haven't for the last week, but
there'll be quite a lot then.
There is. The Mirka says, congrats, folks, on getting a plug in the latest issue of Film Comment, which we sort of do by proxy, because they have, in the latest issue of Film Comment, which is an American film magazine, they have a bit on Letterboxd, and they have a screen grab, and we're in the screen grab.
Yeah, our
we had to pay a lot of money for that.
I know, yeah. I know.
A lot of arms had to be bent. Yeah. But then quality, the cream always rises to the top, doesn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, yep. That's why we're there.
Miriam Ruth Ross says, post-Tenebra Lux, devilish poetic realism.
I was very unhappy to have missed that at the festival, actually. Yeah, that's one of the ones I was looking forward to, and then I couldn't make the schedule work.
Lots of conversations.
Should just point out to our listeners in Auckland that the Wellington branch of the International Film Festival only finished officially on Sunday, and in fact there are still screenings sort of dribbling on. I went to one yesterday. I went to see Norte, which is a Filipino movie. It's only 4 hours and 20 minutes long, and didn't feel a moment over 3.5 hours.
Very good.
It's good.
Like one of the biblical epic sort of films.
No interval and lots of long slow takes. Yeah. Oh. Really good, though.
Another one from Miriam Ruth Ross, Magic, which I'm gutted I had to miss. Chilean Wicker Man.
Wow, that actually sounds really intriguing. And that I think that may have been the screening that played without subtitles, which would have made it even more mysterious.
Mm. And Reese Pye says, I think I realize how I feel about Only God Forgives. Violent, stylish, but no real emotion, so feeling of detachment.
It's a mean film.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have had a chance to catch up with that yet.
I think it might be a bit too much right now.
Yeah, I think you probably do need to get your strength back beforehand. And then watch it before you listen to last week's show and find out Simon and my judgment on it, which is not the same. We were not unanimous.
I just had such high expectations for it. Mm. And then to come out of it and feel like I'd just been self-flagellated for 2 hours and, whipped to death. Well, not that bad. But,
yeah, and not necessarily by yourself either.
No, it wasn't by me. I mean, that's the fine. I mean, if it's consenting, I don't mind. But, but not
that's
like that.
It's weird for Ricky show.
Yeah, but not like that, no.
All right. This is the first weekend, the weekend we've just had will be the first weekend that Auckland has had since their festival finished. So let's see what the box office was doing. What were people going to see?
Mm. In at number 5, tumbling down from 3 is Despicable Me 2. Obviously feeling the end of the school holidays there.
And Universal announced this week that Despicable Me 2 is the most profitable movie in their history.
Wow.
Most in terms of money taken as opposed to money spent. So, boom. There will be more.
Mm. Mm.
Opening this week at number 4, Pain and Gain, which we'll talk about shortly. At 3, up from 4, The Conjuring. That makes sense, going up. Mm. Sitting at number 2, The Wolverine, and holding on to the number 1 spot, Now You See Me.
Two weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks at number 1, and still going pretty strong, I think, that one. And no, still no sign of The World's End doing any better.
Is it in the top 20?
It's at number 11 this week.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Is that an improvement?
No. It's gone down. No. I need to see it again.
I think maybe
I'm panicked. Yeah. It's dropping off of screens left, right, and center.
I know exactly. Yeah, you better finger it out, as they say. Anything else on their site? You're just scouring the figures to see if there's any runes that you can read.
Well, isn't it interesting to see old Gatsby still in the top 20? That's quite cool. Well done.
Chugging along.
Mm. Yeah. And is Remembrance still playing? I realised I hadn't seen it the other day.
It is still playing, yeah.
Yeah, I do need to try and catch that before it disappears. Mm.
You know, what's interesting to me is the amount of, you've got two alternative content titles there in the top 20 with Munch and The Audience.
So right.
I think it's not a bad result.
So those art gallery ones have come off, have they? That was another gamble, wasn't
it?
Well,
certainly The Audience has. I mean, that's can do over, half a million nationwide and keep going, I think. So, yeah, no, that's a very good result.
It'd be nice to see some exhibition films from some contemporary artists. Not a fan of the classics.
No.
An easier sell, though, aren't they? Like, there's an expectation of what you're going to get.
There's a brand. There are brands there. It would be interesting to look at, say, like the a Tracy Emin show. Mm. You know, that famous bed thing that's owned by the Saatchi, and in 3D you'd be able to actually go all the way around it. Sculpture would be really interesting in 3D actually. Anyway, we digress. Mm-hmm. We've hinted at this over a couple of weeks, so we won't necessarily need to go into it in full chapter and verse, but I think it's time that we gave a little bit of a verdict to the Wolverine.
It's an honor to meet the Wolverine.
That's not who I am anymore.
For many years, I have wanted to thank you for saving my life.
You have struggled long enough. I can end your eternity. Make you mortal.
What the hell is happening? What the hell is happening indeed? That's Hugh Jackman. As Logan the Wolverine. And can you remember that far back? It's more than a couple of weeks since we actually sat at Event Queen Street. And
I remember it well. This was a ridiculous screening.
Why? Yeah. Because of the content or the environment?
The environment, yeah. And the audience. It was cheap Tuesday night at Event.
They all bring in their blades.
No.
And haven't you seen those? My kid's got one. You get the hand glove and you got all the blades that come out and go, and it makes a noise and stuff.
Oh, I want one.
That would have been cool, but no, there was no sort of cosplay involved.
No.
It was just a very busy screening, and no ushers, and half the audience deciding that they were going to take seriously the seating on the ticket.
Very serious.
And the other half not.
Right.
And 80% of people in the cinema are on their phones, like, while the trailers are running.
Yeah, it was noisy. There was lots of talking. It was probably what the film deserved, to be honest.
Yeah.
But it was not the most cinephile audience ever.
Just on that note, people on their phones, it's got to stop. It's just got to stop. And when I was at Candelabra, and I was fairly far back, and there was somebody down in the front section who, had pulled out their phone, and it was like it was, a bloody...
It's a beacon.
It's a beacon in the night, like bringing home the ships. And it just was so distracting.
This was the gala for the...
This was the gala opening at the film festival. Now, people, you need to know...
invited to
that one. Yeah, and you need to know better. Whoever it was, he'd hang your head in shame. Shame.
You're too
far away for me to get you, but...
I know that is one of the problems with the embassy and all that wonderful legroom is that you actually have to make quite an effort to reach over and clip somebody around the ear, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they were like quite. I wasn't going to walk that far.
It does often depend on the screening and the time of day, how annoying the rest of the audience are. And at some point, we may well try and have that debate about whether there should be special screenings just for people who work for Google, who can then text and iPad their way through the screenings. But we'll come back to that a little bit later on.
I'm trying to think of a nice word to describe that, and I can't just think of one that I can say on air right now.
It's just like, the I want it now crowd. Like, I want it now. I want it now.
Screening for blanks, a word that starts with T.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so look, we obviously don't want to talk about Wolverine because for 3 weeks in a row now we've talked about everything but.
Mm.
But so this is.
I feel that this is a good discussion because much like the Wolverine and much like its storyline, it just diverges everywhere and it doesn't really make sense and it doesn't really come together and it breaks all the rules.
Because time is a wee bit of the essence on today's show.
You're trying to discipline us, aren't you?
I am. Well, Dan? Just because there's quite a lot to clip into the show after we've finished, you see, because we have two director interviews on
the
show
today.
That's
how the magic happens.
Yeah, and so I don't want the show to be an hour and 40 minutes long. That's all.
We got a lot of passion.
Let's go.
Wolverine.
Wolverine. My first question to you really was it fun? Because you can forgive almost anything if it was fun.
It was a little bit fun, but mostly ridiculous.
Yeah.
There's too many questions. Mostly me going, what? What?
Yeah.
What? And yeah, just the audience was so irritating.
And it was also, it's set in present day Japan, and it doesn't appear to have ever actually spent any time in present day Japan or around actual real Japanese people, because it's, you know, it's like, it's comic book Japan, isn't it? Where everyone's either a ninja or a samurai. And everybody they sleep in little pod hotels or love hotels. I mean, it's just like every Japanese cliche that you could pull out, they pulled out, you know. And you were saying to me that you thought that it was also shot mostly in Vancouver,
but not as bad as that. What was that film Sean Connery was in?
Black Rain,
you know, don't make eye contact.
Oh, no, Rising Sun, that was the one.
Yeah,
yeah.
It wasn't that sort of stereotype.
But
good.
Most of the Wolverine films, for budgetary saving money reasons, are shot in Vancouver and the surrounding area. So, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I don't know how much actual Japan time there was for that. But
either
way,
a large number of Japanese people in Vancouver, so yeah.
If I was a real Japanese person, I would be looking at that and going, come on, there's a little bit more to us than this, really.
But they love Hugh Jackman in Japan.
Well, that's another reason for going, is that, you know, you can tell the whole thing was basically put together for marketing purposes, marketing business and you know, science. Let's try and sum it up in two words.
Is it a good one for the kids, the family?
No, because it's actually quite violent.
Is it? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and because he loses his powers, there's a certain number of special effects which are quite yucky.
Yes. Yep. My two words for the Wolverine are lame pup.
Yep, good, good.
Close shave.
No,
not even that good. My two are silly sausage for the Wolverine.
Isn't it funny though? Because Hugh's got some rather interesting films coming out.
Yeah, this is
just one of those ones he's committed to.
There's a rumor that they're offering him $100 million to continue to play the part, basically in perpetuity. Like, there's a need. For Fox, because this is the X-Men franchise is the only Marvel one that they own, so they're desperate to keep the X-Men thing going, and they need their stars in the same way that Disney need to keep Robert Downey Jr. going as Iron Man, and will pay almost anything for the privilege. I saw a story in the news today that there's a rumor that Christian Bale's been offered $60 million to play Batman again,
and he said no.
Yeah, well, just the fact that that's the amount of money that they're throwing around. This shows you that, you know, that it isn't just about the cape or the cowl. It is about the person under the mask, you know, that people
Okay, I mean, but it's a model that's flawed, isn't it? I mean, everyone keeps getting nervous about these big releases and how so many tank, you know, it's going to be a disaster for the industry. But then they're so top-heavy. Mm. I mean, they're so top-heavy with those sorts of costs. I mean, you know, how long can that be sustained?
Well, we will find out. I'm sure that the doomsday clock is ticking for it. A slightly smaller movie with sort of vampires following on from the Twilight vampire franchise is a little English movie called Byzantium, which I have yet to see. So my description of it now is going to be basically based on what I understand from the interview that I did last week with the director of the film, Neil Jordan. Now, if you you may know Neil Jordan from films like The Crying Game, you know, Academy Award nominee, a veteran Irish filmmaker, a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Irish Film Academy. And after we had two or three goes at making this phone interview work, so I have edited it all together for you, and so here it is. Neil Jordan, the director of Byzantium, and afterwards we'll do a little bit of a giveaway. Neil Jordan, the director of Byzantium, welcome to Cinematica.
Thank you.
Neil, Byzantium's not your first vampire movie, and it's not your first venture into the supernatural either. Interview with the Vampire, the Tom Cruise movie from 1994, was I think the first of the modern vampire films that sort of elevated the genre above the B movie. Transformed itself, the vampire movie, since then. What makes your vampires different? What attracted you back to the subject?
Well, it was the script, really. I mean, I didn't write the script. It was developed by Stephen Woolley, who was one of the producers on Interview with the Vampire. And it seemed this the essentially, I thought it was a script about a movie about somebody trying to tell their own story, you know, which was very attractive to me. And the fact that it moved through time, you know, that it bounced through different periods, and the fact that it was about two sisters on the run, everything about the screenplay was almost could have remained intact if you had removed the word vampire from it, you know. I mean, if there had been obsessive serial killers, for example, you know. I mean, but the reason that they had to be vampires really was because the story moves through 200 years of time, you know.
Mm.
And all those elements really wanted me to make a movie of this, but I had no desire to make another vampire movie in a way. I think there have been too many of them lately, you know, particularly with the Twilight series, you know. But I mean, I think there's still life in the old demon, yes. And Nora Buffini, who had written the screenplay, she did reimagine them as totally different kind of creatures then from what we've seen upstate, you know.
Indeed. There's a sort of metaphoric weight to the vampire legend that recent vampire movies, I don't think, have really taken advantage of. This one, you know, that the immortality, whether you know, the fact that they're basically trapped in an existence that they can't escape from, the outsiderness of it. But this one adds the, I think, very welcome wrinkle of feminism. This is very much a female perspective on outsiderism and vampirism.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was written by a woman, obviously, and that was her. It was based on a play that Moore had written, a play called The Vampire Tale, and when she transposed the play when she wrote the screenplay, the first draft of it, it was almost like a play, you know. And I said to her, "Look, this has to belong to the genre. This has to be a horror movie. This has to be a vampire film, you know, to succeed." And she gradually introduced elements that were about the backstories of these characters, you know, about the...
Damn it. Hello.
Neil, we've got Dan on the line. So
okay, thank you. Hello.
Thank you.
Hello again, Neil.
Oh, Dan, you're the guy who was cut off.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. They're so rude, these people, you know. Didn't even tell me you were the guy. I thought you were a different Dan. Anyway, let's keep going. Yeah,
we'll pick up where we left off and wrap it up before the gremlins get to us again.
Okay.
Byzantium is set in one of those sort of grubby little English seaside towns in winter, one of those places that's always the last refuge of the desperate. Whereabouts did you shoot the film, and what sort of look and character did it offer you?
Well, we shot in a place called Hastings. In the southwest of England, about 60-100 miles from Brighton, you know. And it had this incredibly haunted quality to it, town had. And it was a lot of the architecture and all the features were of that kind of post-war concrete, you know, kind of forbidding concrete stuff. That it was in a huge walkway that went on forever. It was incredibly beautiful, actually. So it just seemed perfect for the film, and there was this wonderful old hotel, you know, I found with this extraordinary lift, you know. So we adapted the story to fit this town, and it kind of fitted it like a glove, really.
The other locations that are, or the other sort of shooting locations that are listed on IMDb are actually Irish, mm-hmm. and was that sort of studio and interior stuff?
Pardon?
What parts of the film were shot in Ireland?
Oh, we did the studio work in Ireland.
Right.
Yeah. And we did the stuff in the west of Ireland, stuff on the Craggy Island, you know, the island that they go to turn into vampires. That was shot. So the Irish sections were shot in Ireland, yeah.
Right, right.
Basically, you know, and some of the interiors, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, but it is essentially an English story, you know. It's a story that happened in an English town that, you know, involves these English kind of realities. And that's what was lovely about it, I felt, you know. I mean, the Brits always tell a great kind of ghost story, don't they? It is.
They do. Mm. I'm very interested in this mother-daughter thing going on in the film, partly because my sister is a solo mum and her nearly teenage daughter, as I can see as she grows older, how complex that relationship is becoming and how more like sisters they are becoming. This is an interesting thing about your film too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had kids when I was very young. My first wife was so close to our first daughter. They almost became like sisters, you know what I mean? And I think if you're that young when you have a child, really, in a way, you're not prepared for the realities of motherhood, you know, so you treat the kid as your baby sister in a strange way, you know? And the older they grew, the more it came to be evident, you know, that kind of thing. The older my daughter grew, you know, so when she's 15 and 16, you're wondering who's the carer here and who's kind of cared for, you know, that kind of thing. I thought it was very true what Maura wrote. They were so close in age, they were almost sisters. But there was a lovely, you know, the strange kind of irony of their vampire lives. In their vampire lives, they are sisters. That's the way I thought of it.
Right.
And in their real lives, they are mother and daughter, you know. So,
there's some lovely casting in there, Saoirse Ronan and Gemma Arterton. Tell me a little bit about working with those two and how did they work together?
Well, Gemma is kind of one of the undiscovered, unheralded treasures of British acting, I think. I think she's amazing. You know, because she started as a Bond girl, she's got this slightly working class thing. She's very often typecast, you know, but I think she's an extraordinary actor, and she was perfect for this role, you know. I mean, she's not afraid of her body and her sensuality. She's not afraid to, what's the word? She's not afraid to kind of, you know, be leonine and sexual, and she's also a great bloody actress too, you know. And Saoirse Ronan, she's Irish. But, I mean, Saoirse Ronan is one of the best talents around at the moment, I think, you know. I mean, she came, the first time I saw her was in Atonement, and she was remarkable in that movie, and has continued to be remarkable ever since. I mean, I thought she was perfect casting for Eleanor. You know, the only problem was that they didn't look like each other. You know, one is brown eyes and tall, the other is kind of blue eyes and is willowy and kind of fair.
Mm.
But the minute they began to act with each other, this bond formed, you know. So, you know, so through acting, they became sisters. They became mother and daughter in a way.
Mm. I'm interested also in your technical collaborators on this film, particularly the one who you've not worked with before, Sean Bobbitt, the cinematographer, and one, Tony Lawson, who you've worked with a lot. And Sean Bobbitt, New Zealand audiences will know most recently from The Place Beyond the Pines, which had lots of greens and browns and foliage and nature, and this is very different. What was the look that you were going for, and what did he bring to the party?
Oh, well, we were looking for two totally contrasting looks, you know. We were kind of looking for a kind of a grainy realism and contemporary stuff, you know. And we were looking for a, you know, kind of a storybook realism in the past stuff, you know, in the 18th century stuff. But, I mean, Sean is a remarkable cameraman because he operates everything he does, for example. He never uses an operator. His sense of composition is so strong, and his... I've never had so rapid and quick a shorthand with a cameraman before, you know. And so it almost felt like a third eye kind of thing working with Sean, you know. But then his sense of color is incredibly bold, and his sense of composition is incredibly graphic and strong, you know. There's a new breed of photographers has emerged in the last 10-15 years, you know, and I think Sean is you know, prime among them, you know. I mean, from the Storaros and the Vilma Sigmunds, you know, the people one remembers from the 70s, you know? There's a whole new approach to these. The game has emerged lately, and you know, Sean is emblematic of that approach. He's pretty great.
Yeah. Was this shot digitally or on film?
Yes, it was shot digitally. It was the first time Sean. There's a new electric camera, the Alexa camera, which has kind of brought digital photography to a new level, and that's the first time Sean has used it. It's the second time I'd used it. I've used it on the TV series I did, The Borgias.
Yeah.
but it's kind of a different. I mean, it doesn't replace celluloid, you know, but it's finally has reached a point where you see, okay, this is a different animal, you know, it's not better, not worse.
It's its own thing. Yeah. Tony Lawson is a name that that not many people would know, but once you've seen his credits, you'd look at them and you go, wow, you did that. I mean, this is the guy who cut Barry Lyndon for Kubrick. He's worked with you since Michael Collins. How important is an editor to you, and how important is the long-term relationship that you have with him?
Well, I've worked with Tony since Michael Collins, actually. I've worked with Tony, and, you know, we have... I think I'm the only person he's worked with since then. He's the only person who's cut my movie since then, anyway, you know. If you get a collaboration like that, you know, it becomes more, you know... It definitely becomes like a colleague, you know. You know, it also... My relationship with someone like with Tony is one like of... I mean, when I write a script, I send it to him, say, what do you think? I get his opinion on early drafts of the screenplay. Obviously, through the entire editing process, we kind of collaborate. And he's also somebody that I can, you know, I can say, okay, Tony, show me what I've done wrong. Or, you know, show me what you would do with what I've shot. You know, show me what your vision of this is, you know. So it becomes a true and a very rare collaboration, really. But I mean, Tony started editing very, very young. I mean, he worked with Sam Peckinpah.
Wow.
You know, he recuts Patrick Garrett and Billy the Kid for him, and you know, Nicholas Rogue actually was his mentor in a way, I think. You know. So he's been around for a long time, and he's, I suppose, you know, he was lucky to you know, be editing films in England with such great directors who were working there, you know.
Indeed, what an amazing track record. You mentioned the Borgias a little bit earlier on. So much of your time recently has been taken up with that show. You created it, you write it, and you direct a lot of it. Was it a relief on Byzantium to be working on something that you didn't have quite so much ownership of?
Yeah, it was a total relief. No, it wasn't a matter of the owner. It was a relief to be working on something that begins and ends, you know?
Right.
You know, so at the end of a 10-week period, you can say, okay, well, that's done now. You know, on these TV things, they obviously go on forever, you know. And but the shock, it was also quite shocking because in the 80s and 90s, television was always the poorer cousin to film, you know.
Mm.
But now it's almost the reverse has happened. If I can explain myself, like on the Borgias, every episode we have a budget of about $5 million, you know.
Mm.
And we have these huge, splendid sets, and we have these great costumes, and we have a studio setting, you know. And it's like shooting a huge production, really. On Byzantium, it was an independent film, and it was, you know, the level of budget, the budget reconstructions were extraordinarily tight, you know. So it's really...
It's a complete reversal, isn't it, of how it used to be?
Total reversal, yeah. Very weird, very, very weird. And I'm sure... If I were to shoot a big Hollywood movie again, as I probably will, you know, it'll be money flowing like water, you know what I mean? But the fact that independent film has become so squeezed is kind of terrifying, you know?
And,
you know, I'd go from planning something on Byzantium to go back to the Borgias, you know, and, you know, a proper car would collect you at the airport and take it to the set, you know, go back to the Byzantium, and you'd be lucky if you get a minicab to... you know, to your trailer, and you wouldn't even have a trailer. Like, it's like, it was terrifying.
Neil Jordan, I hope you do get a chance to work on some really big Hollywood pictures again. It's been a pleasure talking to you on Cinematica. Sure. Thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's Neil Jordan, the director of Byzantium, and we have some 2-for-1 passes for that that you can use wherever the film is screening. So, I guess just. Get in touch with us through one of the many ways that we are contactable. And if you just hashtag Byzantium or something like that to let us know which one you're after. And we, the first 3 of people who get in touch, we will send these passes out to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time for some news.
Last week, Bruce Willis was unceremoniously dumped from Expendables 3 by a Sylvester Stallone tweet accusing him of being greedy and lazy.
That was so cool.
Get out there, man.
Whoa.
And it's like, oh, I've got Harrison Ford.
I want to see them scrapping at that. What is it, the planet, the food place?
Planet Hollywood.
You know, like...
Are there any of those left?
I don't know.
I think so.
Yeah, the Auckland one closed in a bit of a disarray a few years back. Anyway, sorry.
This week in an interview with Spanish magazine XLS, Willis all but admitted that he only does action films for the money. Explosions are one of the most boring parts of my job, they quote him as saying. When you have seen a few fireballs, it's not exciting anymore.
And my message for Bruce is, watching Bruce is one of the most boring parts of my job.
No.
All I can think of right now is, shut down in a blaze of glory.
But the thing is that he does a little bit later on in the interview, he does admit that while he does those films for the money, he does those so that he can also afford to do slightly smaller films like Moonrise Kingdom and what have you. So he is actually probably as busy as he's ever been. It's just that a lot of those choices are really, really, and you can tell the look on his face that he's really not into it. Red 2, when does that open?
A couple of weeks.
The trailer's playing in front of almost everything at the moment.
Yeah, 29th.
Yeah. So, and I must admit that I thought he was sleepwalking through the first one of those, let alone the second one. So, who knows?
Yeah, I thought it had a charm to it, and it was funny, and it's like old people sticking it to the young ones is great. Can't get enough of that.
It's like the best exotic marigold CIA hitman squad.
That's right. Good on. And to be honest, I'd rather watch Bruce.
Yeah, than Harrison Ford.
Yeah, I think so. Get off my plane.
I'd rather watch Bruce than Stallone. At least you can understand what he's saying.
Okay.
Sheesh.
Nah, Stallone with the big quivering lips. That's fine.
Yuck.
The sex doll look. It's cool.
Ew.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
You know how his lips kind of go, that's all the work he's had. Like, he can't kind of close his mouth. You look at him. Anyway. Yeah. Carry on.
Nightmares. If you're the kind of movie fan who gets excited by B-grade actors and low production values and bandwagon jumping, then you'll be pleased that Vendetta are giving the Sci-Fi Channel's notorious cult hit Sharknado cinema screenings next week. Yeah, get your axes out.
What? Where are they?
The screenings are at select locations at 9 p.m. on Friday, August 23rd.
Wow.
Sharknado stars Ian Ziering and Tara Reid and is about hundreds of CGI sharks terrorizing Los Angeles after a freak storm. Much like Birdemic, but with sharks.
Yeah, I know.
Like, I think the CGI values are about the same as
But wasn't there one... There was one not long ago about people in a car parking lot. No, in a mall.
In a mall.
Yes.
Which actually was a proper film.
Well,
in its own sort of limited terms, it was a great idea, badly executed. This one is like a really dumbass idea, but it may just come to life in the execution. Who knows? But it is,
I suspect with Tara Reid, can't help but work.
Yeah, you'll be there.
Oh, yeah.
In slightly more sensible news, two more Kiwi films have been added to the Toronto Film Festival lineup. Tua Fraser's Giselle and Dana Rotberg's White Lies will join the dramatized documentary Beyond the Edge 3D, which was announced a fortnight ago. Yeah.
That's a good result for all three titles, isn't it?
Yeah, great. It is. And it's a really good result for New Zealand and the Film Commission. So I know that there's a lot of... it's a really open question whether Giselle is going to break out to cinema audiences beyond the ballet fans that we know that are going to be interested in it. We'll find out tomorrow, Thursday, because that's when it opens.
It opens tomorrow in
New Zealand. I'm looking forward to seeing it because I just, having interviewed Tara Fraser and Leon Narby, the cinematographer, I know that they went to enormous amounts of trouble to shoot the thing as beautifully as they possibly could. And so I figure that, I'm not a ballet fan, but this would be, if you can't go and see it in live, this would be the way to do it. And in fact, probably even better than live because of the ability to go close and actually, look at the dancers' movement and the physicality and the feet and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, very much looking forward to that. And also interesting result for White Lies, which got mixed results here in New Zealand from local audiences. I think that perhaps we're a lot tougher on local movies and local history than perhaps international audiences are, who aren't so familiar with all of the intricacies of the issues. So yeah, we'll be interesting to see how that plays.
What lies though is hanging in there. You know, it's into week, you know, 7 weeks that it's played for now, and it'll, and I think it just took a wee while for it to find its audience, then plot along. If you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And certainly it targeted an audience and has done a reasonable job of going in and going and getting it. So yeah. Okay, it's time to go to the gym.
My name is Daniel Lugo, and I believe in fitness.
Mr. Doble, are you currently using steroids?
I think they messed me up.
Don't worry, that's what we specialize in here. Penis magic.
We got through with this, nobody gets hurt, right?
Oh man, we snatch him.
There he is!
We grab him, signs a few signatures. We give him a protein shake. You don't even know what happened. I watched a lot of movies, Paul. I know what I'm doing.
Okay, Pain and Gain, Michael Bay. This is a film that, you know, that had almost nothing going for it in terms of pre-interest and pre-excitement from me. I just thought, you know, the reviews have been pretty mixed for it. Michael Bay, as we all know, is almost artistic death for anything cinematic. Even though this is a relatively low budget. You know, doesn't have, it's not full of effects or giant robots or any of the rest of it, unless you count The Rock. But it's this is a film based on a true story about something that happened in Miami in the middle of
the 90s.
94, 95. Yeah, that's right. About a group of bodybuilders who decide that the world owes them a living, so they kidnap a local businessman and force him to sign over all of his assets to them. They think that they've disposed of him, but in fact they haven't. And then, of course, the cops come calling. It's on the surface, it's a pretty dark story, but it's done with a conscious attempt at a comedic sort of approach to it. Kaylee, what else is there to say?
Well, as you said, it stars Dwayne The Rock Johnson, also Marky Mark, who had some great 90s moments shooting hoops, and all I could think, like, all that was stuck in my head was the Funky Man.
he even strips down to his Calvins at one point.
He does, yeah. And I was like, that is such a nod to your past, buddy. Yes. That's such a nod to your past. And also Rebel Wilson makes an appearance as the girlfriend of one of the characters, and it would have been great to have more of her on screen, because they just sort of let her run with it, and she's so funny.
Which is what people do now. They pretty much just let the camera run. And I thought that she was about as funny as I've ever seen her, actually. She's pretty good.
Mm. And she didn't have to put on an accent, which was nice.
I just get the feeling that they knew what they were buying, you know, when they cast her. Yep, you just run away.
So when I first saw the trailer, I was actually quite excited to see it, so I've been hanging out waiting to see it, which is strange because it's a Michael Bay film, but it did not let me down. It is so much fun. It is so funny, and Dwayne Johnson is brilliant. Like, I've not seen him in a role so funny, so, like, buff, and just so against his regular character. He's this sort of con man who, when he was in jail, had this, like, spiritual awakening and spent his time in jail saving others from being beaten up.
And he's sober.
And he's sober, and he's just this big, humongous, hulking teddy bear, and it's just so insanely funny.
He's got a really light touch, hasn't he? You know, and there's a really... You can tell that he's not just taking the piss out of the character that he's playing, but also his own persona. And you know, his action hero persona as well.
And I really ended up cheering for him. Like, you really want things to go well for him, but it's just not going to.
No. And this is a film that really surprised me, because usually with films like this, that basically hates everybody. Like, it hates, it's contemptuous, isn't it, of all of the characters. It's contemptuous of Miami. It's contemptuous of the cops. It's contemptuous of bodybuilding culture. It's cynical. It's manipulative, and it's dark. And usually these are the kind of films I go, oh, look, can we just have somebody? Can we just have one person in here that we can root for? Or you know, but it sort of hates humanity, but it does so with such commitment and gusto and verve that it's hard not to enjoy. I'm pretty much convinced that the stuff that I didn't like about it, which of which there was quite a bit to not like, I'm going to blame that on Michael Bay. And I'm going to basically assume that all the good stuff is from the script.
So
by Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely.
So why? Because, you know, when I've looked at this, there's just been this consistent negative review. You can't find many good reviews for this film. So why did you guys?
It's got a really funny script. Like, it's really witty. Like, there's
I don't think it takes itself seriously at any point.
No.
And it's got that, like, really bright, really vivid, really oversaturated look that just screams Miami in the 90s. It's just like...
Tom Johnson.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just... It's so silly. And because it's a true story, and there's parts in the story where there's actually titles that say... Reminder, this is a true story.
Yeah.
And it's so preposterous and so ridiculous that you can't, a story like this, there's no way you can be like, you know, really, I don't know.
There's one, there are a few things about it that give me a little bit of pause. One is that it would appear like it's attitudes to women would be Stone Age, would be charitable, I think, in terms of describing it. And the only reason that I am forgiving of it in this film is because it basically hates everybody. You know, so it's reasonably sort of equivocal about how it does that. The other thing that kind of bugged me was right at the very end, and I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to suggest to everybody that, you know, they get caught at the end. But at the end, two out of the three end up on death row, and I don't know whether they actually ended up being executed or not. But that's a bit of a bummer way to end a comedy.
Yeah,
I'm afraid. I'm sorry. Maybe in America where they're used to, you know, that's just a yay. They go boom. Yeah. But actually, we've just been laughing at these guys for a couple of hours, and you kind of. You enjoyed their company, you know, no matter how big, what kind of idiots they are, and no matter what kind of unpleasantness they wield, and then to find that was their fate. It's like, actually, that leaves a bit of a sour taste. So I have to say that's, you know, it's
real life, Dan. It's real life.
Yeah, I guess so. Our friend of Cinematica, Sarah Watt, in the Sunday Star Times, gave this a half star out of five, and she really did hate it. And you know, I said to her last night via text, you know, that I'm going to give it 3 stars, which means I must have liked it 6 times as much as you did. but it's still not a 4-star or a 5-star film, really, but it is. It is a pretty passable couple of hours entertainment, and you know, I just think that I really want to see The Rock. I got to call him The Rock, really.
Yeah,
Dwayne,
someone, Thor.
Do more grown-up comedy. Like, he's done lots of the kids' comedy stuff, which I know he's good at, and he's got a winning sort of screen persona for youngsters.
And
I know that he can be
a stepdad.
Yeah, and I know that he can be a badass in action movies, but I think that this showed that he's got really, really, you know, great comedy chops, you know, and, you know, want more from him. And Mark Wahlberg's as good as I've ever seen him, to be honest, you know.
Does he age? I don't think he's aged since, like...
No, but as I said to you a little bit earlier on, I reckon that he's just got this boyish sort of look about him, which one day is just going to desert him all in one go, you know, and he's just going to, it'll all collapse.
I reckon they've got, like, you know, the studios have got these capsules that they put them in at night.
Must be.
And freeze them, yeah, and bring them out in the morning, you know, and keep them youthful. Big investments, got to make sure. I mean, if you're getting paid, what, $60 million to do Batman, you got to make sure he's looking good.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah. And
Batman doesn't matter so much.
Well, he's got a mask, true, but yeah, I guess you can paint in his abs and stuff, but other films, okay.
No, but you think about, talking of Thor, like Liam Hemsworth, I've seen some before and after photos of him, you know, from his Aussie soap days to his Thor look, and, you know, that That's a pretty amazing change in someone's physicality. And he's now got to maintain that for as long as his movie career lasts, really, because he's
Thor.
He is Thor now. Mm. So there's no question that it's hard work. And if there's a message that comes out of Pain and Gain, is that, you know, there are no shortcuts. You know, no matter how much you might want the American dream, actually, yeah, you do have to work for it. Do you think you can come up with two words for Pain and Gain?
My two words for Pain and Gain are I'm pumped.
I'm just trying to think of my two for this, and it would probably be
Penis magic.
Miami Nice. I don't know. No, that's just that's rubbish. That doesn't even relate to anything. But anyway, look, it was fun. It was a good one. Look. Time to move on to our next director interview. I was saying to Si a little bit earlier on, this is, for some reason this week, we could have had four director interviews of films that are opening this week. It's just they've been...
at our door.
Yeah, exactly, knocking on our door.
Turn some of them away. Sorry.
In last week's show, we had Matteo Garrone from Reality. So if you missed that show, go back to download it. We talk about Gomorrah and his new film, Reality. We've already talked to Neil Jordan about Byzantium on the show. And on Saturday morning, while I was in Auckland for the Big Screen Symposium at Auckland University, I got to sit down with the director of Stoker and probably more famously Old Boy, Park Chan-wook, who is known as Director Park. That's how you address him.
And Sarah, I mean, just, you know, bringing her back in the 5-star film of the year for her, Stoker, wasn't it?
Yeah, lots. And I talked to a lot of people who saw the film on Friday night at the special symposium screening and said that it was their favourite film of the year. So this is, you know...
It's a lot of heat building on it.
Yeah, it is. And he really is like an old school auteur director. He puts his stamp on absolutely everything about his films, and it was really interesting talking to him. It was through an interpreter, so we'll leave the first question intact so you can get a sense of what his voice is, but we'll edit out the Korean for the rest of the interview, so otherwise it'd go on forever. But his interpreter and his personal assistant, who grew up in Lower Hutt, which is kind of convenient, did a really good job of working this situation through. But you know, you ask your question in English and you're addressing your question to Director Park, and he's sitting there with his eyes slightly closed and he's obviously concentrating really hard, and you think, do you understand a word of any of this that I'm saying to you? And it occurred to me actually afterwards that maybe the translation was not a literal translation. It was more like, he's asked question number 6, and Director Park sits and thinks for a little bit and goes, give him answer number 9. Director Park, welcome to Cinematica, New Zealand's favourite movie podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. You're here in Auckland to talk at the Big Screen Symposium, the gathering of New Zealand filmmakers. What did you make of the welcome this morning?
감독님, 그 뉴질랜드에서 가장 인기 있는 영화 포드캐스트 시네마티카 환영하고요. 감독님은 오클랜드에 지금 빅스크린 심포지엄이라는 행사의 일환으로 와 계시는데, 이것은 뭐 전 세계 영화인들이 함께 모이는 자리이죠. 오늘 아침에 환영 의식은 어떠셨는지요?
네, 감동적이었어요. 정확히 어떤 말인지 다 파악할 수는 없었지만, 그 마음은 충분히 전달됐고, 그런 전통 의식으로 환영해 주는 것은 참, 다른 어디서도 못 본 거였기 때문에, 한국에서도 이런 종류의 국제 행사를 할 때는 우리도 이런 걸 해보면 도입하면 좋지 않을까 하는 생각을 했습니다.
Yes, it was very moving. Exactly what were being said, he couldn't understand them all, but at least their heart was conveyed to him. It was very touching. And seeing the welcome being conducted in such a traditional, traditional ritual, it's something that he hasn't seen anywhere else in the world. He was so touched that he got to think, wouldn't it be great if something similar was done in Korea also, where there are many international events like this, but it's traditional welcome isn't part of.
You're here to speak at this the big screen symposium. Do you get to ask to present at many events like this? Is this a common thing for you to speak at conferences like this?
He doesn't tend to do a lot of these sessions, but ones that he recalls, he was part of the Berlinale mentorship program. And back in Korea, he gives these master classes or talks from time to time. But as a filmmaker, he's much more at home when he's making films rather than to talk about them. So he gets quite uncomfortable talking about the process itself. And that's why he tries as much as possible not to do masterclasses or session workshops or sessions like these, but it just so happened that you know, Big Screen Symposium is taking place around the time that Stoker is being released in New Zealand. So because those events are coinciding, he thought, well, might as well.
Yeah, we'll get to Stoker very shortly, but I've got a question for your about your background. You discovered film as a student, and you were also a film critic for a while you were building your career. Do you think that studying film on a theoretical basis is worthwhile for someone who wants to make films, or should they just jump in feet first to make?
Well, when he was young, it was a time when even if you wanted to make something small as a short film, the money that was involved is still pretty high. And it was a time when there weren't many digital equipment or digital filmmaking around. So there weren't much that he could do other than read books. And that's the only, and by no means is reading books more important than actually making a film, but because he didn't have the access to the means, he only resorted to reading books. But and also with the film critic work, he started out actually as a filmmaker before he ever got into the work of film critic. But first two films that he made, they bombed at the box office, unfortunately. So in order to make a living, he had to do something, and a film critic was work that he was doing during that time to put bread on the table, as it were. Not because he wanted to work as a film critic. If he was a aspiring filmmaker in our contemporary time, he would say that, and he would say to all the film aspiring filmmakers and to himself, if he was one of them today, it's short and simple. You don't need anything. You don't need to do anything else. Just grab an iPhone if you don't have a bigger camera, and just go out there and shoot a film.
Excellent.
That was the best thing to become to reach your goal.
Director Park, you turned down several offers of work in Hollywood before accepting Stoker as your first English language project. What was different about that project that made the one that you wanted to choose as your first?
Some might say that it's those Hitchcockian aspects of the film that drew him to the script, but actually it wasn't the case. When he first read the script, he didn't at first even realized that there was so much respect and homage going on to Shadow of the Doubt even. But what really drew him to the script was how quiet it was. The amount of dialogue found in the script it wasn't a script where it was cluttered with dialogue. It's not a film where things go on all the time, but it was a film which is very quiet, and in that quiet, there's a palpable sense of fear and tension all the way throughout, and that's what really he found attractive about the script.
Wentworth Miller's script for Stoker was famously on the blacklist, the list of best unproduced scripts of 2010. Was it ready to go when it arrived on your desk, or did you need to do something to make it your own?
Yes. He really took on the work, and he had the approach to the Wentworth's script as if he would approach an original source material, like a novel. And he thought, he took the same approach as he would adapt a novel into a screenplay in doing his revision of the script. So yes, he did go through the process where he revised the script to make it his own. And 그리고 수정을 필요로 해서 하셨고 캐스팅
그러니까 뭐 캐스팅 미리 다 돼 있었던 것이 아니라
And it was only after that process was complete that the rest of the process such as casting followed.
Stoker is Tony Scott's final film as a producer, and his reputation certainly among critics seems to have grown after his passing last year. What was he like to work with, and what did he bring to the project that you appreciated, and did you learn from working with him?
Well, there weren't many opportunities for him to talk with Tony Scott about Stoker, and that was because at that time Tony was preparing a film of his own. So when he heard the news that Tony had passed away, he, Dr. Pa, was very, very surprised. But one of Tony's projects was to remake his own film, Hunger. And a writer he had selected to take on the job, Erin Cressida Wilson, her participation in Stoker for Director Park is the biggest blessing from Tony Scott, if yes.
Apart from the language difficulties, which I can see you've got working very smoothly here, what was different about working on Stoker in the Hollywood context? Were they cultural differences or industrial process differences? What are Hollywood crews different to Korean crews and Korean sets?
Well, there are differences between crew and industry practice between Korea and America. In every aspect, there are small differences to be found. But fundamentally, they are the same. So from that perspective, it didn't provide such a challenge. But what was very much different and something that he noticed right from the beginning is working with the studio and how studio would have a lot of questions to ask, and they want to share a lot of their thoughts and opinions. It was, to Director Park, quite bewildering at the beginning. However, during the process of their asking questions and him providing answers and their reaction thereof, and throughout all this process, he thought, well, he'll have to make the best of this process. And in the end, the whole process became very productive for him, and he really was involved with enthusiasm at the end, by the end of it, and it enriched his film making as well, in the sense that during rising out of all these discussions, he would arrive at a destination which was slightly different from where he thought he would begin, but where he thought at the beginning. But throughout this discussion, it wasn't a case where, you know, it ended up being my way or their way, but it came to, he was able to think about and come up with an alternative that would be, that would incorporate all the discussions and would and something that not only himself but the studio, they all found to be the best way for the film.
I have one final question for you, Director Park, and that's a personal one, really. There's a lot of darkness in your films, in your filmmaking. Do you use filmmaking to as a way of dealing with your own personal demons, or do you choose that path because that's the maximum impact you can have on an audience?
Well, it's all metaphor, really. We encounter dilemmas on every level during our everyday and ordinary lives, whether it's small or big. It can be as big as work versus love, or something as small as what I want to do after when I finish at work. What do I want to do tonight? So we encounter dilemmas, big and small, every day. But the important question is, what choices do we make when we encounter those dilemmas? And what he is doing is he's exaggerating these dilemmas in a very extreme form, and asking the questions, what choices would you make? And what consequences would you have to deal with after making certain choices?
Excellent. Director Park, thanks very much for being on Cinematica. It's a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Next week we'll be reviewing Stoker. Crikey, what else is there? Elysium. I know, big movie.
The other director, Neil.
Blomkamp, that's right.
Have you seen that yet?
No, I haven't. No, I saw somebody around here carrying the hard drive around with
on. I was checked it out, man. I've seen it. Yep.
You have? Oh, boy, oh, boy.
I'm ahead of you next week. I've seen Stoker and Elysium. What else we got next week?
We're going to talk about Giselle and Frances Ha.
Two out of four, I guess.
So, but either way, it's going to be a packed show, and we're very much looking forward to bringing it to you. Hope you enjoyed the show. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget you can click subscribe in iTunes or your own favorite podcasting software, so the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. You can leave us feedback at the iTunes store. Ratings, reviews, etc., they're all super useful to help us discover audiences and audiences discover the show. You can contact us in various ways.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter via @CinematicaCast.
And this show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme is... Oh, you haven't done it.
No. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd as Cinematica, where you can find our two-word reviews, and of course on our website at cinematica.co.nz. Now I am done.
All right. Are you sure? Okay. The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some more music, and this is from another film that hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about next week, but who knows whether we'll have room. This is Edie Brickell and a song called Go Where the Love Is from The Way, Way Back, which I saw last night and enjoyed, although not quite as much as I enjoyed Pain and Gain. Until next week, that's all from me.
All from me.
And good night from me. Good night.